Thank you, Steve, and thanks for inviting me. Co-author on this, or maybe co-conspirator on this paper, is Larry Morris. I was at the University of Georgia for many years, and Larry and I worked on projects together. I first started working on land application in forests in 1962 at Penn State. Probably some of you are familiar with that. So I've seen a lot of systems over the years, but I've also seen a lot of no change in what we knew back in 1962 and what we know today. What is the objective that we're trying to look at when we talk about forests? Generally, we look at low pre-treatment, minimize the treatment costs. We're going into an area that doesn't have food crops. We want to maximize nutrient renovation in the eastern, more humid regions. We're generally concerned more about groundwater quality. Drinking water standard with nitrate is the most critical standard we're trying to meet. But we always want to protect the receiving environment. So do we try to maximize treatment? And incidentally, I like to use the term land treatment as opposed to land application to the public. That says we're doing something more than just applying the wastewater or reclaimed water, whatever we want to call it, to the land. Do we want to try to maximize the treatment and tree growth on the smallest land area? That becomes a real issue when we deal in more humid climates. Or do we want to try to maximize tree growth? That might be true if we're dealing with more ornamental-type crops. If we're just dealing with pine plantations or hardwood forests, that isn't likely to be the objective that we'd want to follow. Whoops. Where's my pointer here? The assimilative pathways that we're trying to generally look at most critically are first plant uptake and degradation. That's primarily, again, nitrogen. The accumulation in the soil, and then leaching to groundwater. Again, those are the three pathways that we primarily look at in developing a system for land application. So the design factors then are the nutrient loading, the hydraulic loading, how much water, the vegetation condition and the uptake. Generally, we're looking at an already existing forest. We're not establishing a forest. But we'll have to look at what's down the road and what we have to do to manage that forest and what that nutrient uptake will be. And then looking at seasonal application, as in Florida, we have high rainfall at times, anywhere between 1,000 and 1,200 millimeters of rainfall a year. And in areas that don't have good soil drainage, we might have to look at a lower wintertime application and storage then application during the next summer season. So vegetation then, the trees, are very critical to a successful operation. And that is oftentimes overlooked in the engineering side of things when they start looking at it. It's just, well, we got trees out there, whatever type of vegetation is, we need to be worried more about the pipes and things like that. But we must understand the growth and nutrient uptake of those trees under a stress condition. We're talking about continual application weekly of water, maintaining very wet soil conditions, not a alternate wetting and drying as we would expect under more normal rainfall conditions. We have to harvest to remove the nutrients, again, primarily nitrogen. We have to maintain that uptake of the critical nutrients, so we have to look at what other constituent, fertilizer, if you will, would be limiting and make sure that that is an adequate supply to make sure we have, again, the nitrogen uptake. We have to look at net uptake. We also have, as you know, we got leaves falling, return of nutrients to the soil, so we have to look at net uptake and then what the harvest is of that removal. And then we want to have a scheduling of irrigation to have alternate wetting and drying cycles, primarily for denitrification. So we look at this kind of a calculation, and with forest conditions, I've looked at systems, United States, Canada, New Zealand, worked on all those, and generally speaking, we're always looking at nitrogen and or hydraulic loading as being the limiting constituent in forests. So we want to maintain or improve the renovation or assimilative capacity of the vegetation we have. We want to treat the applied waste. We want to control operating costs. And that generally means right up front with the level of treatment, pretreatment that we have, and then maximizing the productivity whenever we can. The cautions are that this vegetation management represents another operation that requires expertise and specialized equipment. It can't be overlooked that the mayor can't have his nephew being the land treatment operator. We find that a good person that has a background in agriculture is the best kind of a land treatment system operator. So our vegetation management must be effluent driven and not forest operation driven. Now here's some shots. We have to use burning to control some understory at times so we can get more uniform application of the effluent. The photograph with all the water on the surface was where the operators were continually driving over relatively, not only saturated soils, but relatively easily compactable soils, and so we see this situation begin to arise. Now, what are some post-design considerations that we have to, in terms of construction, we generally consider using above-ground HDP pipe. This gives us less disturbance. Just think, now we're talking about an undisturbed forest, generally we're going into that has a good forest floor, good permeabilities, so then we go in there and we dig a trench, and yet our design is based upon that undisturbed area. So now we have all this disturbed area that begins to control, and we have some systems that I've seen that have been around for 20 years and are still trying to get past that recovery or rehabilitation of that construction. Need to allow field adjustments. Generally, the forest conditions are kind of rough. It gets laid out, and here's a sprinkler that ends up in the middle of an ephemeral stream channel. Contractor says, I have to put it there because it's on the plans. You need to be able to make field adjustments. Very purposeful, but simple hardware. What we'd like to use is HDP pipe, a 1-inch riser, with a piece of angle iron driven into the soil and clamps holding it up with a. It's very flexible. If it gets hit, it just falls over and you just put it back up again. Nothing breaks. Minimum soil disturbance. I already mentioned that. Restrict construction access. Narrow clearance lanes. We don't need 35, 40-foot construction lanes. We keep it very narrow. Try to keep it down around 15 feet. Limit damage to trees outside the area. We're still counting on those trees growing. And then we want to be able to achieve a pre-construction soil condition just as quickly as we possibly can. So here's an example, some examples of different systems. Here's putting the pipe in. This happens to be with a buried HDP pipe, but it could also be PVC. Here you see the riser that I was speaking about. And if we have only a 15-foot wide clearance path, then we try to put the sprinklers on one side, say 10 feet from the side, so we can still have access for any maintenance equipment. Here's an above-ground system, and that HDP pipe is pretty amazing. You can drive over it and everything. The biggest problem is a lot of people tend to think they have to mow these areas, and so they hit the pipe with a bush hog. They don't need to be mowed. That just creates more compaction and disturbance. So the rehabilitation, we want to be able to restore the conditions equal to design parameters. We want to rehabilitate as we go along, because typically the way these systems are designed, one day there's a stream discharge, the next day it's being irrigated in the forest, and the site has to be ready to take it. We generally try to have about a year's worth of phase-in time if possible. With most regulators don't work that way. They have a consent order. They have to get out of the stream tomorrow, and that's what they have to do. We typically see, and I'm not trying to downplay the role of engineers here, but engineers tend to take the spec book and say, well, this is what we use on roadsides for seeding. This is what we use here. Roadsides aren't shaded. In the forest, it's shaded, and so grassing and so forth has to be tailored to the site and to the conditions that are at the site. And I mentioned phasing irrigation startup to co-assign rehabilitation progress. I'm going to give you two case studies. There were many, many, and we could have tried to combine these, but we thought that we'd just take two. And incidentally, these two that I'm going to show are about 30 million gallons a day between them. In Georgia, I know that we have two, the largest forest systems I'm aware of, amount to about 55 million gallons a day. So that's just in two systems right there in forests. This is in the Piedmont. Clayton County is just south of Atlanta. It's an activated sludge plant. Irrigation began in 1983. The soil is a loam to clay loam with fairly steep slopes, 5 to 20% slopes, more towards the 20%, 15 to 20% average. Have a typically the Piedmont on a jillic horizon with a low saturating conductivity in that jillic horizon, so we see a lot of lateral flow. And that's critical to understanding the hydraulics of the system and also our wetting and drying cycles and denitrification. Application rate is a little bit higher than what we would typically use today, a quarter of an inch per hour. We are more commonly down around 0.15 to 0.17 inches per hour. Hydraulic loading in this case is 2.5 inches a week. The interesting part about this is that the site is at the headwater of the drinking water supply. There's over 17,000 sprinklers in the system. This is the system right here, and here's the county line right here. So this is the irrigation system through here. There was a, this is the stream moving into the drinking water supply. This road right here is on the ridge, and this is the Eastern Continental Divide. Everything here flows to the Atlantic, and everything over here flows to the Gulf. So it's a very unique kind of site. The Atlanta Airport, many of you have been in, is only about 10 miles to the north of this. Incidentally, this area was first acquired in the early 80s, and you wouldn't find that today. There's a road running through the site right here which people live on, and coming down through here, there's houses all through here now that were built after the land treatment systems put in place. These are storage lagoons. The treatment plants are about 6-7 miles away. The annual discharge, because this is drinking water recycling, was important to know. So after irrigation began, this is what we see. Pace Creek is the watershed that's receiving irrigation, and this is sort of the regional average. We had a little bit of a droughty period, and then we got into a wetter period, but you can see that that base flow or total flow was increased after irrigation began. Looking at groundwater nitrate concentrations, irrigation began here. This is two, a maximum of two, but generally running around still half a part per million of nitrate. So very successful in terms of nitrate renovation. Nitrogen storage in the soil, this is work that Larry has done. We see good nitrogen accumulation in the surface, and this is after 15 years of irrigation, so you can see that we still have a good bit of nitrogen capacity left in the soil. Denitrification, this is kind of interesting to me. We've always tried to design new systems for denitrification and had done some research work. This is after some long term. I would have thought that the toe slope would have higher denitrification, but I think the reason we don't see that is because the toe slope stays wet all the time. We don't get that alternate wetting and drying. So in a summary for this system, approximately 75% of the irrigated wastewater returns as base flow. We didn't see any significant increase in storm peak flows, which is good. The volume of storm flow, just because the recession curve on the hydrograph was longer, the volume was increased. We saw an increase in biological activity, you should expect, especially earthworms, and we had good maintenance of soil permeability. Uptake and denitrification were the principal nitrogen assimilation pathways. We also saw good phosphorus accumulation throughout the soil profile. Now, the next case study I wanted to discuss was in Jacksonville, North Carolina. This is in the coastal plain. It's a very rapidly growing area. It's the home of Camp Lejeune, and so there's, with all the middle activity lately, it's very fast growing. It started out as a 6-million-gallon-a-day system. We just increased it to 9 million gallons. It was formerly a commercial timberland, so it was a relatively large chunk of land, but it was also interspersed with a lot of wetlands. So we saw that to get 810 hectares of irrigated land, we had to have the system scattered about over 2,500 hectares. Sandy loam soils, the slope is less than 2%. Really, it's almost, over most of the sites, less than 0.5%. So we have very high seasonal water tables. In 2009, we increased the flow to 9 million gallons a day with 1,000 hectares being irrigated out of 3,400 roughly. The field investigation, because of the site conditions, required a very intensive soil mapping and permeability measurement. And it wasn't just the soil mapping. It had to be mapping of the landscape position as well, because the rule in North Carolina is that you need to have the water table drop to within 12 inches of the surface 2 days after irrigation. So we had to really know where the landscape position was so we could make sure that that water table would drain. Again, no subsurface drainage is used. This is all just natural drainage. We came up with two types of soil polygons. The primary suitable, which was the well-drained and moderately well-drained, which had a higher hydraulic loading in the winter, in the summer than in the winter. And then we had what we called seasonally suitable, which is only irrigated in the summertime when the evapotranspiration was high. And the total area had to be sized to take care of that winter storage. This is how that irrigation system might look. The different colors are whether it's seasonal or primary suitable. Now, we found an interesting thing here a couple of years ago, that because of the way they were managing their ponds, their pH was going up in their ponds from a 7 to around 8.5. We began to see some impacts of the trees. And we found out that manganese was, because of the increase in soil pH, soils were not that well buffered, that the trees were beginning to show decline in the canopies. And in manganese, these are trees that hadn't shown any change yet. These are trees that had shown some change, and this is what was in the areas that hadn't been irrigated. So the bottom line with forest systems is that we've got many systems around the world that have been functioning for 25 years or more. To have a successful system, it requires good soil mapping and tailored loadings to the soil and the vegetation. I think that's true for any system, but for forests is what we're talking about. You need to identify critical construction, implementation, operational factors up front. It can't come in later. Construction activities have to be developed for the landscape. Operation manuals and then following those operation manuals are critical. Again, not just for forests, but important. And then implementation of a forest management plan that's compatible with what your objectives are. The objective is really treating the wastewater, and so we got to make sure the tail doesn't wag the dog. City councils tend to look at this as a source of income. It's not. Questions? Do we have time for questions?
One question?
Yes. The question was whether we've looked at urban conservation practices on treated water quality. Well, I have to say that until a recent state water plan was developed in Georgia, there wasn't any real water conservation practices. So, there's a water war going on right now, at least that's what it's been dubbed in the press, between Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. And it's surprising to me, I've been working this for almost 50 years, that even hydrologists don't understand that the very thing we showed here, that most of that water, when we have a high rainfall area, is running back into stream flow. They look at total 100% consumptive use. And our state water plan, the draft of it, was written as if land application had 100% consumptive use. and we have a lot of education to do. I might add that when I first started working in this back in the 70s and the early 80s, EPA had a very good technology transfer program, and that went away. And we see the effects of that, I think, in that there's a lot of research going on, but it's not getting out there to the people who really are applying it. The researchers know about it, but people who are doing applications don't know about it. So consequently, we see land application, land treatment, not being at the top of the alternatives cycle. So, thank you.